There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. I'm excited to introduce you to Shannon Bragg Sitton, an old friend who has been in the nuclear industry a long time. She started off as a student in Texas A&M and has been at the Idaho National Laboratory quite a while. I'll tell you, let her tell you more about that. But she is currently serving as the Associate Laboratory Director for the Energy and Environment Science and Technology Directorate at the Idaho National Lab. And as is usual for government-type agencies or government-associated agencies, titles are just long and even hard to fit on a business card. But hey, welcome. How you doing, Shannon?
I'm doing great, Rod. Thank you so much. It's great to be talking with you again. And yes, it's been a while. We've known each other through a number of different phases of my career in the nuclear industry, going up and down. And yeah, now I lead the Energy and Environment Directorate. And yeah, it's a really exciting place to be.
One of the things I've always thought about you, Shannon, is that you're a leader, because one of the first interactions that I had with you, you were one of seven people that formed the organization called NAYGN, North American Young Generation in Nuclear. And I always admired that, starting up from almost nothing at a time when there weren't very many young people in the nuclear industry.
Yeah, I think that when I look back on that, NAYGM was a really fun time. You found some really motivated people that truly believed in what we were doing on nuclear energy. And our motto for that organization, if that's the right word, probably not, but it was that nuclear is alive and kicking. And that's since been changed, because we don't need to say that. That's been proven, that nuclear is necessary as a part of our energy mix, alongside many other technologies, to meet the growing energy demands that we've got right now.
Now, one of the things about your current role is that you're not completely focused on nuclear, even though the Idaho National Laboratory is digs its roots deep into the nuclear industry. Over the years, the laboratory has learned to do other things and has become an expert. But tell us a little bit more about what the Environment, Science, and Technology lab does.
Absolutely. So I joined INL in 2010, so it'll be 16 years this fall. And I joined in the Nuclear Science and Technology Directorate as a nuclear engineer. That was one of the draws to come to INL, doing some interesting things. I was doing space nuclear work and spent about 11 years in the Nuclear Science and Technology Directorate here. And what brought me over to the Energy and Environment Directorate is really the idea of systems integration. So I was fortunate enough to really launch a program under the Department of Energy on integrated energy systems, really looking at the time at how nuclear could be complementary and operate in a coordinated fashion with renewable technologies such as wind and solar, and what all that entailed. How do we bring in energy storage? How do we bring in heat users? How do we better utilize that electricity so that we don't have electricity to throw away, but that we efficiently use all those investments and everything that we can create? That led to an opportunity to move to the Energy and Environment Directorate here at INL about 5 years ago or so. And I was first a division director and have been in my current associate lab director role for about a year and a half. And what's really exciting about this directorate, yes, we are in a nuclear laboratory. We're the Office of Nuclear Energy Lab, but you can't just build reactors. You've got to make sure that they are going to work within a system. We need to talk much more about energy systems. How is the system impacted by different generators on the grid? But also, how are we using energy? So the Energy and Environment Directorate is all but the nuclear. Essentially, we take that nuclear that's developed and say, how is that going to interact with the grid? How do we ensure that we have a reliable, resilient, and affordable grid system for small communities, large communities, centralized, decentralized? Then also, how do we take advantage of the primary outputs from nuclear technologies, which is heat? whether it be a light water reactor or a higher temperature advanced reactor, how do we take that heat and connect that into industrial applications? Maybe we're making hydrogen, and hydrogen then becomes a building block for different molecules for chemical synthesis. Maybe we need to use that hydrogen in our refineries. So, really starting to look at that holistic question, if I've got lots of energy sources, how do they come together? So, big parts of our portfolio in this directorate are that integration piece. On the development side or energy generation side, we also cover biomass-based systems, water power, geothermal, huge opportunities for geothermal that are growing at this point in time, particularly in the Idaho region. Lots of great resources, but also then looking at how wind and solar connect to the grid. And then what are those other technologies we need to think about? What do we need to do to make chemical synthesis more effective, more energy efficient in how we build molecules going forward? How do we use that energy to drive domestic critical minerals and materials processing so that we can domestically source things like rare earths and other materials that are very critical to our energy security and to our national security? So we have a really wide portfolio that is a lot of fun to work within and brings all of these technologies together.
I'm sure you occasionally have to deal with people who say, "Why do you need all those other sources? Nuclear can do it all." What would you say to them?
Well, number one, we're seeing significant increases in electricity demand for the first time in a very long time, in about 20 years, driven a lot by data centers, but also bringing industrial manufacturing back onshore in the United States. We have a lot of energy demands, and they're growing. And we need to be able to look at what each of these generation technologies brings as far as benefits to the grid. Nothing is free. And nothing is a silver bullet solution overall. So nuclear likes to run at base load. It likes to run flat out, nominal capacity, and it has a very high reliability, capacity factor, 93, 94% in the United States. So it's a great workhorse, but we have flexible demands. And so if you have a solid flatline resource, and you have flexible demands, well, then we have to start thinking about, do we need to redirect to storage at the time at some times? Do we need to overbuild? How do we actually do this? Other generation systems are very good at fast ramping. We may be able to bring in a natural gas-fired system for fast ramping to hit peak demands or to hit the demands of certain industrial cycles. Wind and solar, they have low upfront capital. And in some regions, they're really very good resources, but their downside is that they aren't dispatchable output. They aren't a nominal capacity. They instead are intermittent or variable capacity. So if we take that and kind of amplify the value of it's a low cost to put it on the grid and couple that with that really solid dispatchable resource such as nuclear. Now we've got a great complement to one another where they have different benefits and we can scale them appropriately to best meet the demands. Now we can look historically at France, which at one point had on the order of 90% or so nuclear power on the grid. They actually had to design their systems to operate a bit more flexibly, and I'm not going to get into the physics side of how those were designed differently. But it was because of the flexible nature of demand and the fact that we have demand changes on the weekends, day, night. They actually had to run their reactors more flexibly. So some might say less efficiently for the fuel resources. And so now they are actually reducing the fraction on the grid for nuclear and bringing in more of these other technologies like renewables just to have a better balance to the grid. Now, they're not taking nuclear offline, but as they build new assets, they're thinking about this mix a little bit differently. And we do need to think about that in order to meet all of these variable demands at the same time. And every resource is beneficial in different regions, but one solution in the Pacific Northwest is not going to be the same solution as you might find in Arizona. So we have to look at the region, you have to look at the demands, and then understand what is the best resource mix to meet these demands in the most cost-effective and reliable manner.
Over the history of nuclear, people have recognized that there's a nice match between that baseload power that wants to run steadily all the time and storage, which can be stored, the energy from the flat baseload can be stored overnight. There used to be a phrase often used in the energy world of using cheap overnight power to charge up your pumped storage facility, for example. And right now there's a facility being built out in Wyoming, the TerraPower's Natrium facility, which comes with installed thermal storage. I've also noticed that there or heard a lot of people talk about how various forms of chargeable, rechargeable batteries are getting far cheaper. Have you done some modeling or even physical testing of the matches between storage and baseload nuclear?
Absolutely. So energy storage can be a key component to building a more flexible system and one that better matches the demand. So let's back up a little bit. If we had a grid that is fully built out with variable renewables, wind and solar, they aren't there all the time and we have to have storage. But it means we have to have grid scale storage, really large system, long duration battery systems. And we need to think about how that matches to the technology. Do we need electricity storage, which is generally higher cost and shorter duration? Or could we couple it to thermal storage if you had maybe a concentrated solar facility? When we start thinking about matching these technologies and allowing a baseload system to support variable load, storage is a great opportunity to act as a capacitor in the system, to hold on to that and then provide that surge power in a manner that the reactor itself is agnostic. It doesn't care. It keeps chugging along at the level that it's designed to operate at, putting that flexibility on the storage system. So yes, we've done a number of studies looking at how would you size the storage in a particular configuration? How would you keep in mind that the storage technologies may be different and they may have a shorter lifetime than your reactor might? So you have to bring that into the optimization study. And we've built a set of modeling and analysis tools that allows us to optimize system design, including subsystem sizes, as well as then looking at operational optimization and how you would dispatch power under different scenarios. So we might configure it to where we have a brownfield installation. So maybe we've got existing generators on the grid, maybe some renewables, some natural gas, and then we want to bring in a nuclear plant. We have to look at the users in that region. Maybe we've got residential users, industrial applications, maybe we've got some other dedicated applications. And we can look at use profiles and begin to understand where we might need to store that energy to ensure that we can maximize use of what's being produced. What that does is it allows us to shrink down how much energy needs to be stored. So now we're not talking grid scale storage, but something much more appropriate to the installation itself. Then we can get into discussing types of storage. So most of the storage that people think about is electrical storage, lithium ion batteries. Those bring their own challenges with lithium availability, challenges with associated with lithium reacting with air. If you were to have a failure of some sort or with water, we have to understand those hazards. They can be mitigated, but there are different hazards that come into that. And they're generally shorter duration than we might need if we needed something for seasonal storage. So winter to summer type of storage, types of systems where you may have high generation of renewable energy in the summer, say with solar, low generation in the winter. So you need to move that generation to that seasonal shift where you might need more energy. So building electrical storage large enough to do that is very, very difficult and expensive. Thermal energy storage offers a lot of other opportunities and can be brought down in cost significantly. You still have to think about how do I do that so I have longevity of storage. But if you're coupling it to a reactor, that nuclear reactor primarily produces heat. That's its primary output. We later convert that to electricity. So now we're storing that energy in its native form, and we can then use it as heat if we need to use it in an industrial application or district heating, or we can convert it to electricity when it's needed and put it out there on the grid. Now, I'm going to bring in a third type of storage, and that would be chemical energy storage or molecular energy storage. What that might look like is using that energy, heat, and electricity that's being generated to produce perhaps hydrogen, where hydrogen's really just a couple of protons versus electrons when we talk about electrical storage. And we're now storing those in a molecular building block. Now we can take those protons and later convert them to electricity again, which is kind of low value use of that hydrogen. Or we can take those protons and combine that with captured CO2 from other processes, and we can make things like synthetic fuels. Or we can use those protons, that hydrogen, to make fertilizers for agriculture. And that way we can better utilize the energy, save that energy for when it's needed for different applications. Now, I want to quickly jump into the TerraPower example. TerraPower and their Natrium reactor, that's just one example of looking at nuclear systems a little bit differently than we have in the past. So, nuclear is costly, nuclear is big, is some of the general understanding. What Natrium has done is they've shrunken the nuclear island. So all the things that are touching the nuclear component is brought down to a much smaller piece, which reduces cost. And then everything goes through a thermal energy storage component for initially conversion to electricity. But that sets them up in a way that it doesn't touch the nuclear licensing, it doesn't touch any of the nuclear design. And later, they might connect that thermal storage system to an industrial user that just needs heat. So they've made their system much more flexible in operational space, but then also over time by shrinking down that nuclear island in the initial design. And several other companies are taking that lead and also moving down along that same path to make their systems much more versatile.
When they do that with the thermal storage, my understanding is it separates so that the primary side, the nuclear side, is treated one way under QA, and the other side is completely divorced from the primary side so that you can use a different set of commercial grade quality instead of the NQA1. Is that, am I understanding correctly?
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up, Rod. That's another component. So I mentioned cost savings because you can reduce what's considered nuclear grade. So that relates to the concrete and to the stainless steel, all those components that need to be end stamped. And that those are higher cost. And once you put that through that thermal storage, you have isolated the nuclear side, and then you use that thermal storage with a heat exchanger to deliver heat wherever it's needed. And now those downstream applications can be standard off the shelf. For example, if we're using a power conversion cycle for a nuclear plant, it might cost 10 times what it does for a coal-fired plant in its current configuration, simply because that would need to be certified for nuclear use. But now with this separation, this islanding of the nuclear piece, we can now use that same technology that's used at a coal-fired plant for the power conversion side, for that heat delivery and conversion to electricity, as you would at a coal plant. And you've just dropped your cost significantly for that balance of plant side of the power plant.
Many of us always thought that didn't quite understand why the steam side had to be treated so much differently in a nuclear plant. But it turns out a fair number of the reactor trips happen because of something on the steam plant side, and it the they ended up classifying many of those items as important to safety instead of safety or safety significant rather than safety related, which is a, you know, that's a NRC rhetoric or definitions that are hard to explain to people. Once it gets to that level, yes, the cost can be a factor of 10 or even more. I remember many years ago buying a valve that was exactly the same as in a non-nuclear system, completely non-nuclear in the forward part of the ship, and The nuclear version cost $20,000. The non-nuclear version costs eight. Pretty
It's
incredible.
astonishing. And this is where we have to start looking at applying the right criteria in the right way. So we need to ensure safety 100%. And by doing this, it doesn't decrease safety. In fact, what you just mentioned, Rod, is that seam side could cause trips on the reactor because of that coupling. Now, by decoupling it through storage, we've actually increased safety and reduced cost.
Yeah, because there's no longer any chance, because they are thermally divorced. There is and tested to show that nothing that happens on the steam side is going to have any effect on the nuclear side.
Absolutely. And I'll add another piece, going with my new role now in this Energy and Environment Directorate, or maybe a multi-purpose directorate, all things energy. Now we can start thinking about a number of different thermal sources that may come together, that this isolation, this separation really helps. So perhaps we've got a nuclear reactor portion of that, a geothermal system. And maybe we've got industrial waste heat. So you've got very different heat qualities. You've got different delivery timelines, different temperatures that now you can bring into storage and thermal energy management to utilize that heat in an appropriate manner to deliver it to the various users. You might even bring in that concentrated solar system. Again, different quality of heat that we need to manage effectively to deliver that thermal energy, that heat at the right quality and at the right time to various users. So we're marching down that path of much more versatile systems through a number of these shifts in thinking about how we design our power systems.
It's always great to turn something considered to be an annoying waste product into a valuable product. It would make my Depression era parents very happy to hear that that's what people are working on.
Well, Rod, I'll say, when I first met you, I was doing very much space nuclear work, and we're going to do space nuclear propulsion, which we're doing again now. And we're going to put a reactor and an electric propulsion engine, or maybe we're taking that reactor and putting it on the surface of the moon or Mars. And when we do that, when we put a power system of any sort on a planetary body, we don't talk about curtailing energy. We don't talk about just dumping it to the environment. We use everything. So what these integrated systems do is start bringing that thinking of truly remote operation of power systems into the mainstream. How do we bring those same concepts to what we do terrestrially? We don't need to dump heat to the environment. We don't need to curtail those reliable sources. We need to just redirect that energy to save it for something later, to build other molecules, to do something with, to have higher value overall. And as you said, that Depression era says, all right, we're using every little scrap. You don't throw the fat and the bones away, you do something with them.
Everything but the squeal, as they used to say in
Yep.
Chicago. You are probably one of the most experienced microreactor people that I know. What kind of feelings do you have about the current effort to build more microreactors and deploy them in remote areas and, in some cases, control them remotely, just as you would a space reactor?
Yeah, microreactors are a nice little sweet spot for me. I started with what I might call nanoreactors with the space applications. And a number of years ago now, maybe 10, 12 years ago, I can't remember exactly when, I was asked to start up the microreactor program for the Department of Energy, really building off that space reactor experience. There's a lot of corollaries there in trying to make something on the megawatt scale for very specialized purposes, whether that be for a remote mining site or small community or military application. And I think that's the fundamental thing here is microreactors are not for all applications. We are not going to build hundreds of thousands of microreactors to meet all these growing energy demands, but they allow you to right size nuclear energy for a specific application. So if we need to go and operate at a remote mining site to access a critical mineral for a few years, a microreactor that can be put in a Connex container on the back of a truck or on rail, taken out to that site, operate for that time frame, and then be shipped back to the factory for refurbishment. That changes the game on how we operate those types of facilities. So I don't think microreactors are here to answer all the challenges that we have with energy, but they answer some of the challenges in unique ways that we can't do with anything else. So if we think about some of the areas in Alaska that have to bring in diesel for all of their energy needs, or are still using oil to generate electricity to heat their homes. If we look at regions that are hit by hurricanes and they need quick response, reliable energy, microreactors start playing a huge role in the opportunity space there. So what defines a microreactor? First started the program, people wanted to put a number on it. And I said, well, you can't really do that. Now, I know there's a lot of disagreement out there with this position. A lot of people have different opinions, and this is my personal opinion, is that the microreactor is not so much about the power level, but about how it can be factory fabricated, packaged in a transportable unit, and taken to the site. Now, some of those microreactors may have their lifetime on a single site and not be designed for mobility after operation, whereas others may be designed for mobility after they've operated for some period of time to allow them to be picked up and moved. That to me is what really defines microreactors, is the ability to factory fabricate, ship to site, and then after they've been used, ship back to the factory for refurbishment and redeployment. And the power level varies because we can be talking about many different designs of those reactors using different types of coolants and different types of fuels that set a very different limit with regard to that transportability for some of those options. So I'm excited about microreactors, but I'm not overly excited. We still need the large scale gigawatt reactors as well as those hundreds of megawatt small modular reactors to fill some of those needs as well.
Yeah, I'm with you, but I would not want to have a shoe store that only sells size 13s and doesn't sell size 3 or 4 or 5. We need a menu. We need a catalog of the right size for the right purpose.
Couldn't agree with
With
you.
the
It's not selecting one
use,
or the other. It's a mix.
absolutely. With using microreactors, say individually, at a mine site, what kind of flexibility would they need, and how can you smooth out the power supply to meet the needs of, say, a single data center where the people think about the power as being always on, but it's not always the same level? As a matter of fact, it's pretty spiky.
Yeah, that's where energy storage comes in. And let's start with that mining site where maybe you're shipping out your reactor in one Connex box on the back of a truck, and you ship out your power conversion system in another Connex box on the back of a truck, and you've got a unit that sits between on for thermal management. And that could include that storage component as well as delivery of heat directly to some of the parts of that application. By having that component in there, you can start managing those fluctuations. You could also use hydrogen production in there. That hydrogen can then be stored for later power production use or other downstream applications. So it comes into selecting those right storage mechanisms to be the right capacitor in the system to balance the demands to ensure that we can meet the demands of a mining site. And then if we look to a data center, one option that we can start looking at that's going to be a little bit bigger potentially. Anytime you have a dedicated resource and a dedicated generation, you don't want a single point of failure. So that's why you see many of these designs for microreactors and small modular reactors as well being multi-unit systems. So maybe we need 5 megawatts at a site for a data center. I wouldn't put out a 5 megawatt reactor. I'd put out units. Maybe you'd have 3 or 4 units that allow us to provide for that data center demand, such that you always have that option to be refueling one or doing maintenance on one of those modules and you're never down. but still you need to have that flexibility in how you operate the system. We also hear a lot of concern about data center cooling and water management systems. We can start thinking about how do we design in the cooling systems that use evaporative coolers, use waste heat from these systems to start cooling those data centers and reduce water use as well. So we need to think about the overall utilization path and how we use each of those knobs, whether it be multiple small units, different storage mechanisms, and different ways of managing that heat such that we minimize the impact to the environment with water use, land use.
You've talked about making hydrogen and some other synthetic fuels. Do you envision some sort of ability for the generator to supply electricity when it's really important, really necessary? There's a peak load going on. And then when the load kind of drops off, the generator shifts back to producing, or the nuclear reactor shifts back to producing synthetic fuels or hydrogen or some other product. Is that sort of flexibility in the vision that you guys write about?
Absolutely, because the production of hydrogen, as I said before, that's we have to think about that as just an energy carrier, just like an electron. We may have a system where you only need that for peak power, but we really have another application that we are driving that energy to. And hydrogen's just that molecular energy carrier. Now, we've heard a lot over many decades about a potential for a hydrogen economy where everything would start moving to a hydrogen economy. I don't think that's the right avenue. It's really thinking about that hydrogen and what it enables. It enables that connection of really reliable and reliable, resilient, and dense energy sources like nuclear to go into agriculture. Because you then have that hydrogen and you build ammonia-based fertilizers. We can use that hydrogen directly, combust the hydrogen to create the heat necessary for some of these applications. And the lowest hanging fruit, the lowest value use of that hydrogen is when you take that through a processed fuel cell, for example, and make electricity. Because we just put all this energy in to make it into hydrogen, you have losses when you go back to electricity. But if you need it for peak power, that's a different game. And you need that power, you need to produce it, then that's okay to do. But I really like to think about it as that connecting point, a heat exchanger, so to speak, where we take upstream heat and energy to downstream products. Now, synthetic fuels, those have gone up and down as to whether or not that's valuable. Why not just use primary oil and gas? Well, we're seeing now that sometimes that primary oil and gas is coming from foreign sources that are impacted by global dynamics. And that's driving the cost of gas to go extremely high once again. So, if we have that ability to use other power sources to get to the fuels, drop-in fuels that we can use in our vehicles, that becomes a much higher viability. Now, one of the questions that often comes around hydrogen is, well, that's too costly. Why would I do that? And it becomes a question of how are you going to use that hydrogen in the end? If you're only making electricity, I agree. It's not going to be economically viable. If you don't care about emissions overall and you have plenty of natural gas, you can get hydrogen from steam methane reforming, and that hydrogen's used in a wide number of industrial processes. But if we want to use that natural gas elsewhere, maybe you're in a region or a country that you don't have the natural gas, splitting water using electrolysis is a great way to get to that building block to make all of these other things. Now, at INL, we focus on high temperature steam electrolysis, meaning we take water molecules in the form of steam, break those down into hydrogen and oxygen using that thermal energy and electricity from a nuclear reactor, for example. That oxygen also has high value in chemical synthesis and is a not a an afterthought. It's also a primary product. Colleagues at the National Lab of the Rockies, they focus on low temperature electrolysis, water electrolysis, and it's some different pathways, different processes. It's also an applicable pathway But it's lower efficiency because we've gone through that electricity. They use some different materials in the process. And we're all about how do we do this as efficiently as possible to take energy from point A to your downstream point C or D.
So what I heard you say is that in some cases, heat from SMRs might be re used to replace SMR in terms of steam methane reforming.
Yes, exactly.
And
So that's a good question.
I also want to say that I used to operate electrolyzers, and we threw away the hydrogen because we really wanted the oxygen. It was a high-value product that allowed human beings onboard submarines to keep breathing.
Yep, exactly. This isn't new. And we've done this for years in a very small space on submarines where we make sure that our sailors can keep breathing. And we've done a lot of studies looking at co-location of systems, co-location of nuclear with hydrogen, with refineries, with industrial processes. How close do they need to be to get efficient transfer of heat? How far apart do they need to be to ensure safety and to decouple systems so that we don't have massive crosstalk that could lead to an industrial accident? And we've refined that quite well. And I love your example, Rod, because we've been doing it for decades. Now we need to bring it into how we think about our industrial hubs in our port cities, in our manufacturing areas of the country. How do we actually think about this a bit differently?
Yeah, another thing that experience on board submarines taught me about hydrogen is that it's a very sneaky gas that can get out of almost anything. So you got to
Yep.
be very careful about leakage and the ability to produce hydrogen nearby the user is also valuable.
Yes. And so we've looked at what is better. Do you put that separation between the reactor on the upstream side and the hydrogen producer, the electrolysis system, and put that electrolysis system right by the end user of that hydrogen? Or, where do you put that? And so we do those types of optimizations based on the unique scenarios. And we've worked with a number of utilities working with existing reactors. We've worked with advanced reactor developers. We've worked with a number of different electrolysis companies, those that make these solid oxide electrolysis cells, as well as working with the downstream end users of those products in the oil and gas industry and the chemical industries. So we've worked with all of those partners and ensured that there's clarity on when does each regulatory body come in, and that I'll say there's still a lot of work to be done there. Where does the Nuclear Regulatory Agency come in? Where does the industrial regulator come in and the electricity regulator? How do they all work together to make this functional, to make this efficient, and the shared risk model across those partners is equitable? And I'm glad you brought up the two SMRs. We often get into this, the small modular reactor versus the steam methane reforming, because we might use that small modular reactor to break down that natural gas and have that as our source for hydrogen, just as what much as we might do that with electrolysis to get hydrogen and oxygen out. When we talk about steam methane reforming, of course, we're taking that natural gas, combusting it for the heat, and using that heat also to break down more natural gas to get the hydrogen. So it's not as efficient in how we use that resource overall, but there's a lot of different scenarios that we can look at depending on where we're deploying and what we really need.
All right, Shannon, I am going to maybe ask a more personal question that allow you to maybe do a pitch for INL. You've been there for 16 years. That's a long time for someone of your caliber, your scientific experience, your engineering, to stay in one place. What kept you in Idaho?
It's a lot of fun. So I came up here, my job just prior to coming up to Idaho, I was a faculty member. I was down at Texas A&M, which is a wonderful university. I was teaching in nuclear engineering and really did love that. But I was very focused in one technology area in utilization of nuclear energy and space applications. And I decided I wanted to branch out a little bit and I wanted to try something new, learn a little bit about other application areas of the nuclear technologies I was so passionate about. And I decided to come up to Idaho. to work across some different areas. Now, when I did that, I spent a lot of time talking to people, getting outside my comfort zone, learning about other aspects of the laboratory, and thought I'd stay here for a few years. And here I am almost 16 years later, and I never looked back, and I still work with the universities quite a bit. But what kept me here was the ability to learn something new every day. I came in working on space nuclear power and propulsion systems. I moved into the fuels associated with those, the nuclear fuels. That led me into working on light water reactor fuels and accident tolerant fuels. I got engaged on doing this integrated energy systems work and building a better system and having a very broad systems engineering perspective. Got started on microreactors, and now I'm leading all this diverse portfolio. I don't have time to get bored or look around because there's something exciting happening around me all the time. And what I love to tell young people is that you have to learn to ask questions. You have to learn to get outside your comfort zone. And sometimes you have to be willing to take on an assignment that you think is really scary, that you don't have the basis in, and trust that the person asking you to take on that assignment sees something in you and knows that you can be successful. And I've done that multiple times here at the laboratory where somebody asked me to get outside of my lane, and it turned out wonderfully. But I stayed in a questioning attitude. When I got brought into a new area, I wanted to ask all the questions, build up my knowledge so that I could speak to that, but never get to the point where I felt like I was conveying that I thought I was the expert in the room, because I had a lot of other experts in the room, but I was the consolidator for some of that knowledge. And I stay here because I love the work, I love the technology. But let me bring in the personal side of that too. When I moved up to Idaho, I had three young children, very young children, and a tenure track faculty position is a little challenging when you have three under the age of five. And I came up here to Idaho, and it has been such a wonderful environment to raise a family. We love the mountain region. We love smaller cities. We love getting outside, and it's just been such a fantastic area. I have such a long list of places I want to go visit, to hike, and do all these things that we never run out. We never have that exhausted. And it's exciting to see that my oldest, who's now going into a senior year of college, wants to land back here in Idaho because he sees the same thing.
Yeah, it's home for him and the rest of your kids. That's a wonderful thing. I was hoping you get to the reason the Idaho magnet, the thing that
Well, I
people
can
think
tell
of it
you.
as somewhat remote, but it is really small town America with some gorgeous, not just scenery, but landscapes and ability to go places. It's a little bit different than College Station.
Just a little bit, and I'll say the weather's a little bit better too. But we just love the vistas, the mountains, the opportunity to drive any direction and see incredible things. And when you think about Idaho, why is INL here? It's out in the middle of nowhere, somewhat. It's out in the desert. Well, it was here because it was somewhat in the middle of nowhere. And there's such a legacy to the Idaho facility, and it's gone through multiple names and multiple operators. It's been Idaho National Lab now since 2005. And because of its remoteness, that's why we've been able to do so much with regard to the development of new nuclear technologies. But the legacy of the laboratory is also rooted in the energy and environment side that come along with that. In how do we make sure that those early days of nuclear energy development, when we were just beginning to understand things, that we make sure we understand the environmental footprint, remediate any previous work that was done, and we steward our natural resources very, very well, whether that be land or water or subsurface resources. And Idaho has all of that in one place. And it's really an amazing place to live, where you can live and play, and you can work and play. It's really a wonderful place for scientists and engineers to come out and learn all these wonderful things. And it just continues to grow. The energy here keeps continuing. I will admit, I wish there were fewer cars because more people are moving here because of all the excitement around nuclear technologies and the development. And it is just a beautiful place to live. But I'm not going to naysay the growth because it's all very good and very positive.
I noticed an awful lot of new housing going up, and listened to my Uber driver bemoan the fact that there were some fairly small housing units that are now renting for well over $2,000 a month. She just couldn't
Yeah.
understand.
I used to say the cost of living here was really, it was negligible. It was so much smaller than anywhere else. I can't say that quite as much anymore, but it's not quite Boise over on the other side of the state. So that's really rocketed up.
Well, I did enjoy my visit out there and was excited to note the recent startup of three new reactors, with one more on its way by the end of the summer, I'm told, or maybe even by the end of this month. So we'll
So
see how
the
that goes.
four overall, I have to say, even the reactor that was started up in Utah was assisted by Idaho National Laboratory.
Of course.
Three here on site, one down in Utah, and yeah, by the end of the summer, potentially one or two more.
Yeah, because there's a couple in Texas that are moving along too,
Yes,
also
there are.
assisted by Idaho National Laboratory, and
We've got our footprint everywhere.
that's good. Hey, Shannon, thank you so much for taking the time. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention that I didn't get around to?
I think just one thing that I want to underscore, coming from the nuclear side, I didn't understand a lot of these other energy resources until I really started working on integrated technologies and understanding how we balance their use. I would just ask that anyone who has a really strong penchant for or against as a particular energy technology, take the time to learn, to listen, to understand what that system looks like, whether you're learning about nuclear, but you're a researcher in wind technologies or vice versa. Take the time to talk to those other researchers that are passionate about their technology. Close the door, hash it out, try to understand the value of both. That has been incredibly rewarding. I've had the opportunity to work across colleagues at multiple national laboratories that excel in renewable energy or fossil energy. And we've really developed a community of respect for the different technologies, a community of understanding that there is no perfect solution. And that is to the point where we've developed such trust that I can go talk about their technologies at meetings, and I'll trust some of those people to go talk about the nuclear technologies. And that's extremely valuable. And we have to understand the technologies before we can judge them. And I find judgment before understanding happening way too much in our society. And I've learned a lot through engaging with other energy technology developers, and it's been phenomenal. And so I would call myself more of an energy engineer, passionate for energy resources and how we use them more than anything else right now. I just happen to know a little bit more about the nuclear technologies.
Oh, thanks for the conclusion. That's great. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to talk to you, Rod. I've always appreciated your podcast, and I wish you well.
Thank you. This is Rod Adams, host of the Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. I've been providing insights into atomic energy and advocating for better nuclear industry performance and accelerated growth since 1995. I hope you've had the chance to enjoy and learn from many of these posts and podcasts. But that's not all I'm doing. 6 years ago, I entered into a partnership that lets me invest into some of the most exciting young companies in the energy industry. With my partner, Valerie Gardner, we launched Nucleation Capital Fund I, a non-traditional venture fund to focus on investing into ventures that we believe are well-positioned to flourish. Those companies will help us all reduce dangerous dependence on fossil fuels by using ever-increasing amounts of abundant, affordable, dependable, and clean nuclear energy. If you are an accredited investor, you can join us. What makes us non-traditional is that we allow regular people to invest in innovative private ventures in amounts from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We reduce costs and risk by building diversified portfolios using an online venture fund custodian. That custodian can help you determine if you qualify under SEC rules as an accredited investor and helps make our fund accessible and affordable. Investors subscribe at the level they can afford for the number of quarters they prefer. We've made 25 investments, and we continue to see many exciting investment opportunities. If you believe in the long-term prospects of nuclear energy and want to put a portion of your patient investment dollars to work, please reach out, as every quarter we make 1 to 3 investments, but you have to be subscribed to get an allocation. Please visit our website, nucleationcapital.com, where you'll find a wealth of information. That's nucleationcapital, all one word, .com. If the content you find stimulates you to take the next step towards investing, please fill out an investor interest form.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.